and looking forward to having him back. I guess the best way, and I think he's sort of shy, and I don't want to embarrass him, so I'm not going to do a long deal here. But, you know, the big book tells us, if you want what we have, well, Bob, I want what you have. So here's Bob up.
I have ulcerative colitis. Well, I used to have it. I'm just making a joke. My name is Bob Olson, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I haven't found a need or an excuse to take a drink today, nor have I found a need or an excuse to take a drink since May 28th, 1973, and for that I'm truly grateful. It's been really exciting to watch the jousting this weekend between Oklahoma AA and California AA. I've been getting a lot of mixed messages since I got here. Creighton, I was talking to him earlier. Creighton and I have been with each other in a couple different conferences, and I always enjoy spending time with him. And I was telling him how much I enjoyed these guys from California and how humorous they are. And he said, "Yeah, you're about as humorous as a train wreck." This is true. Now, when I came into the lobby when I got here, a woman came up to me and said, "You know the last time you were here?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "You really made me mad." And I'm going, "Well, what are you supposed to say? Good?" Yeah, that's what you do say. Good. Well, I must have made some kind of an impression. And then she went on to explain that. And then I was standing back here by the back door, and this guy came up and he said, "Boy, let me tell you, the last time you were here, you started talking, and all I could think of is, oh my God, do I have to listen to this monotone for the next hour?" Yes. And if you absolutely don't want to, nobody's locking the doors. I was thrilled this morning when Larry started talking about elderly Scandinavians as child molesters. Some little additional benefit to my heritage. To tell you the truth, I probably enjoy dry humor more than anything, and Charlie's just super. You did just a hell of a fine job, both you guys did, and so did Creighton. Unfortunately, I didn't get here early enough to hear the Thursday speaker, but I can tell you that you really have a treat tomorrow morning with Vince. Vince and I have been on programs before, and Vince just does a wonderful job. I'm really happy to be here. You know, I was just over in Jekyll Island, and I left Denver, and it was 39 degrees in Denver, and I got to Jekyll Island, and it was 36 degrees. And I don't know if this is just following me around, but your temperature down here is about what it is where I live, which is really spreading. It's cold down here. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for that wonderful basket of stuff that I almost got myself sick eating last night. I got a case of the munchies about 9 o'clock and ate everything. I was not real successful with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started going to AA meetings in 1968, and I knew that there was a problem. I just didn't know how to get to it, and there was a lot of stuff that was causing problems. One of them was that I always used to go to AA meetings drunk, and I had a couple of doctor friends. I was very successful in business, working for a Fortune 500 company, a big paper company in Wisconsin. And had several doctors as friends. And they noticed that I was quite nervous. And so they, you know, they had all the wonder drugs back then. And so I learned how to not go into DTs early. You just dose yourself up with Librium or Valium, and you don't do that. And so so I had been drinking a lot for a long time, and what I finally had to do the last 5 years that I was drinking was that when I got up in the morning, I'd have to take a bunch of barbiturates not to go into DTs, and then I could get through until it was socially acceptable to drink. And the point was always to get to the drink. The point was, what do I have to do to drink? In May of 1973, I had been back and forth in AA again and had recently been to an AA meeting and had gotten a sponsor. An old guy named Leo, and he did all the things that sponsors are supposed to do, I guess, when you first come through the door. He sort of babysat me and did a number of things, and it just didn't make sense to me, and I did that for about a week, and then I took off again and called him up and told him that I didn't think I was an alcoholic, and his only comment was, "I'm sure we'll see more of you." And it didn't take very long, frankly. On the 28th, of May, my wife had left me with our son and had gone to Europe, and I went on a running drunk, and I stopped, I know, for a couple of days at my parents' house, although most of that trip is a little foggy, and I remember her saying, and I was telling her that I thought I might be an alcoholic, and she said that I wasn't an alcoholic. And I said, "Then why do you hide your booze every time I come to your house?" And then I wound up on the floor of this empty house in a little town in Wisconsin. And the next thing I knew, this old sponsor of mine was looking down at me on the floor. And I was absolutely certain I was going to die. The only thing, back then they didn't have treatment centers anywhere near there. I think there was one in Minnesota. I think that Hazelden was there, but I had no way to go there. And so they didn't know what to do, basically, except just babysit you through it. They'd just get you someplace and walk with you most of the time. And he was making me drink orange juice and honey, which someone had talked about earlier, which is just awful. I mean, no one would drink that voluntarily. And they kept pouring that stuff down me so I wouldn't go into DTs. And I could have told them, "All you got to do is give me about 100 milligrams of Librium and we can stop this whole baby right now." And the guy that was with him was a guy named Dick, who was sober a couple of weeks. Appropriately named, and he kept dancing around me going, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, what's he going to do? Is he going to go into DTs? Is he going to have convulsions? What can we do to him? Should we take him to the hospital? Is he going to die? What the hell are we supposed to do with this guy? You need to tell me what's going on." If I would have had a gun, I would have shot this son of a bitch. They took me. They took me to the guy who had the answers, who happened to be a priest that ran a halfway house. And they plopped me down in front of this guy. I really thought I was going to die. And let me describe the position, because it's a position that I hope all of you who are alcoholic have reached. The position was that I knew absolutely that if I took another drink, I was going to die. I had been drinking so much for so long, and even with my chemistry background, could not find a way to put off the effects of withdrawal from alcohol any longer. I had drank so much that I knew if I had another drink, I was going to die, that it absolutely would kill me. I would lose control, I would get alcohol poisoning, and I would stroke out, or something was going to happen, but I absolutely knew I couldn't survive it one more time. And the other problem was that I knew if I didn't take a drink, I would die. That's a bad position. And at one point, I really didn't care. You know, I just wanted it over with. You can't stay in that position. It has no hope. They plopped me down in front of this priest, and he said, you an alcoholic? And I said, yep, I am. And he said, is your life unmanageable? And I said, for Christ's sake, two people just carried me in here. And he said, well, I'm not stupid. I just said I was a drunk. He said, do you want what we have? And you know what? I didn't care what he had. It was better than what I had. And if I could have traded him right on the spot, I would have done it. Okay? And he said, if you want what we have, then you need to do what we do. Are you willing to go to any length? And I said, yeah. Well, what do you lose at that point? I mean, you got nothing left. Everybody's gone. You're going to die. And what they did was the kindest thing they could have done for me. They took me home. Okay? They took me home and said, gets too bad, give us a call. And they left me alone in the house. And I went through 72 hours of the worst stuff I have ever experienced in my life. I went through DTs and hallucinations and flopping around like a fish out of water for 72 hours in that house all by myself. And if you haven't had that experience, you really should try it sometime. I saw stuff crawling out from underneath my refrigerator that you don't even see on Saturday morning cartoons. I saw the most... I had taken like 3 or 4 giant cans of Raid and goddamn near asphyxiated myself in the kitchen trying to kill all of these things that were coming out from underneath the refrigerator. I took a refrigerator that was too wide, picked it up like this, and stuck it in the middle of my kitchen, and then couldn't move it back when I got sane again. But my fingerprints were embedded in the side of the refrigerator. I spent 72 hours of absolute terror where I knew I was going to die every minute of that period. I knew something was going to seize up and that was going to be the end, and I was terrified the whole time of when that would happen. And see, I kept trying to pray to a God that I didn't even believe in. I kept praying. I didn't know how to make them listen. I would pray on my knees and on my back and on my stomach and standing up and sitting down in Old English and New English. And I go, how do you get to this guy? And the truth is that you don't have to do any of that. Okay? All you got to do is say, God, help me. When I got through with that, I knew what the deal was. You know that normal temperate drinkers don't experience that? Huh? That only real alcoholics experience that. So The book says we had to concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step for recovery. The delusion that we're like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. I'm not like other people. I do terrible, tragic, bizarre things to those people who are closest to me. And the reason why I do it to the people who are closest to me is because they're the most convenient. Okay? Anybody that would be in my family or would live around me might as well have had a bullseye painted on their forehead. I mean, we take targets of opportunity, and we abuse the people who are closest to us merely because they're closest to us. Okay? Because when we strike out in anger and frustration, it's always those people who are most convenient and the people that we want to hurt the least. The book talks about average temperate drinkers. I have two older sons. I have five sons. But I have two older sons that are normal temperate drinkers. And they drive me nuts. I don't understand them. When my oldest son, Tom, got old enough to drink in Colorado, I said, "Are you going to get some beer today?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "I'll buy it for you." And I said, "What do you want?" And he said, "Well, what will you buy?" And I said, "Whatever you want." And he said, "Heineken's, right?" So we went and got a six-pack of Heineken's and went in and sat down at the kitchen table. And he opened up this bottle and poured it in a glass, which I didn't understand. I mean, I think that you're supposed to work real hard at not swallowing the bottle. And so he pours half of it in a glass and drinks two-thirds of half of it. And I'm just watching him. I'm waiting for the flash. And there is no flash. And pretty soon he got up and he said, "I have to go do some stuff on the lawn." And I said, "Well, aren't you going to drink the rest of that beer?" And he said, "I don't think so." And I'm sitting there staring at him and staring at the beer. God bless him. You know, he's a wonderful kid. I don't understand temperate drinkers because I'm not one. It says there's a certain kind of heavy drinker, and it's curious because when the book describes a heavy drinker, it talks about people that do almost everything that we do. They wind up in courts for divorce or drunk driving. They wind up in hospitals. They get liver damage. They get in freak accidents because they drink. They stumble around. Occasionally they have a blackout. They do stuff like that, okay? But the thing that differentiates a heavy drinker from an alcoholic is that if they are given a sufficient reason, they can stop as an act of the will, okay? Which means that if a doctor comes up to him and says, "You got a liver like a football, you're going to have to knock that off or it's going to kill you." And they just stop. Or if their spouse says, "One more drink or you're out of here," they stop. They just don't ever drink again. Or if a judge says, "You get in front of me once more, Buster, and you do hard time," they stop. Just ends right there. That's a heavy drinker. But what about the real alcoholic? The book says if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely. Okay? How'd that affect me? Well, I quit a lot. I just couldn't quit entirely. I mean, I'd go, "I'm not going to do this again." And then I wouldn't do it again for a day or two. Sometimes. One time I did that for a whole week and didn't do it again. But at some point, I lose control, and then we're off to the races again. Or once you start, you have little control over the amount you take. Well, you take an average temperate drinker or even a heavy drinker on occasion, and they'll tell you that they're going to have two drinks on the way home from work. And that's what they do. God, how do they do that? And they can do that all the time. But you see, with a real alcoholic, I can walk into a bar, I'm going to have two drinks on the way home from work, and I don't get home. Just something happens in the middle of that, and everything that I had planned to do goes right out the window, and I get all new plans and designs about what I'm going to do from that point forward. And it really, and everyone in my life is gone from that plan. Okay. I would not take care of my children or my wife if it meant I couldn't drink. My wife would say, Bob, there's 2 feet of snow on the ground. If Tommy doesn't have boots to go to school in, he's going to get pneumonia. And it's only a couple of bottles of booze. And I couldn't do it. And she'd say, you know, I understand if you have no respect for me, but please, at least respect your children. There's no food in this house. And if you don't give me some money, there's going to be some problems here. And it's only a couple bottles of booze. And everything in my house was measured in bottles of booze. Okay? And I couldn't do it. And it's not because I want to be a jerk to my kids or a lousy father or an irresponsible husband or anything else. It's because I cannot, absolutely cannot, put any priority in front of my ability to get the next drink. Okay? That's what I am. Well, I went to the meetings in this little town, and it was funny because they had one of these sheets. You know, I was a year sober, and somebody handed me the big book and said, will you read how it works? And I said, where's the sheet? You think God doesn't love us a bunch? I always sort of jump back when I see that. I'd been sober, and let me tell you about my second step experience. I'd been sober for 90 days. And my sponsor came up to me and said, why are you sober? And I said, it's because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a salesman, okay? And he said, bullshit, which was his favorite expression. He said, you've been hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous since 1968. You never got sober before. What are you doing differently? And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, are you eating differently? And I said, no. And he said, are you exercising differently? No. Are you going to work? No. Well, you must be doing something differently. And I said, well, I wouldn't know what it was. Well, you're going to meetings. Yeah, but you went to meetings before, didn't you? And I went, yeah. So he said, that's not different. You got a sponsor, but you had a sponsor before and you drank, so that isn't different. Do you read the big book? And I said, occasionally. And he said, did you read it before? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, that's not any different. What are you doing differently? And I said, I don't know. I don't know, Leo. And he said, well, are you praying? And I said, uh-huh. And he said, why are you doing that? And I said, because you told me to. And he said, did you pray before? And I said, no. And he said, why not? And I said, because I don't believe in that. And he said, well, maybe that's it. And the only difference between my drunk times and my sober times was that prayer. And he said, would you concede that you're sober today by the grace of a God you don't even believe in? And he was right. See, in my experience, God is so gentle and so polite that he will not enter our lives unless we invite him. And even if we invite him and don't believe in him, he will enter our lives anyway. And I asked him to come in. And he did. The book says if you're even willing to believe. Even willing to believe. Doesn't mean you gotta believe. See, because a lot of us have this problem about if I can't see it, I don't believe it. If I can't see a manifestation of it, I don't believe it. And believing in God is an act of faith. And we are not given to acts of faith. And so the book says if you're even willing to believe, you don't have to know anything about God. You don't have to know what He is. The theological argument is if you knew God, you'd be God. Because God is so many things and so great. So you don't have to know. All you got to do is want to know. Upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. The cornerstone of my sobriety is a willingness to believe that there is something out there that not only is greater than I am, but that loves me. Talks a lot about power. You know, in that part of the book, lack of power is our dilemma. You believe that? Huh? You ever see a new drunk? Get a new drunk coming through the door. Don't let him get in a treatment center first. Get him right through the door, okay? And then sit him down, let him shake and sweat and pee and do all the stuff that Charlie was talking about. Sitting down in front of you and shaking and not making any sense at all and asking about all the power in their lives. Say, how much power you got in your life? You got the power to have a checkbook? You got the power to live in a house? You have the power to stay in a relationship. You have the power to have your children love you. You have the power to stay sober. You have the power to do anything in your life. Because the truth is the lack of power is our dilemma. And the funny part about that is that I'm 23 years sober, and lack of power is still my dilemma. Because I don't have any. I never had any. I won't ever have any. It's all God's, and He lets me use it. Okay? He gives me all the power I can stand. What do you do with it? What's the proper use of power? Don't use it. Okay? Sometimes, and it happens to convention speakers, I'm so happy that people are sitting up here and saying, please, please don't think that convention speakers are anything special. We are just talking heads. Okay? Somebody gave us a message, and for some reason, I can talk better and I can make coffee. So, in the pecking order of things, we are about six steps below coffee makers, and that's where we belong. Okay? So be kind every once in a while. Come up and tell us you heard us or something. But that's about all that really needs to be said. Okay? It talks about the definition of the power. You know, when you get an AA and people go, well, he's got that tree as his God. Or use the doorknob or any of that silly old shit that people would talk about in AA. I can't believe anybody would be stupid enough to say that God was a doorknob. You would have to be a raving imbecile to believe that that was the most powerful thing in the world. What if it comes off in your hand? It says that power which is God. The two things that I think that I worry the most about in Alcoholics Anonymous is we don't have a very clear message. Okay? I'm as guilty of that as anybody. I'm not pointing the finger at anybody. You've had wonderful speakers here this weekend, and none of them suffer from that. But the truth about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we're terrified that we're going to hurt some drunk's feelings. Oh, my God. You think you're going to hurt a drunk's feelings? If you're Creighton and you just walked out of a Lady Kenmore box, for God's sakes, you're afraid of hurting his feelings? He's going to die right in front of you. Let's not talk about God. You know what? You know what the book says? Stress the spiritual feature freely. What does that mean? It means don't hide God in a corner. Don't apologize for God. We don't have to apologize for that. This whole program is spiritual. This program is about adopting a spiritual way of life based on what we understand is right and wrong, which is our intuitive thought. Okay? And the whole thrust of this program in recovery is to get as close to God as we can, and God takes care of our sobriety. Okay? So my responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous is to grow spiritually every day. Okay? That's my responsibility. My responsibility is to get as close to God as I can, and God will take care of my alcoholism, and He's done that for a long time. I know that works. Okay? The problem comes when we decide that we don't have to follow the directions. I love this. Back to basics. Do you know what the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous are? The only thing that we had in the beginning were the 12 steps. You know, when Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob were running around Akron and they got a brand new drunk, what'd they do? They stuck him in a hospital so they could control him, right? And they put him into bed. And then they sat down and they talked to him and they shared their experience with him. And pretty soon the guy or the woman understood that they were also alcoholic, okay? And then they asked him if they believed in God. And the guy could go and, you know, say no. And they go, well, that's all right. We don't find that to be a big impediment, but you're going to have to find a power greater than yourselves. And the guy would find that, and they'd pile him out of bed on his knees next to his bed. Read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And they'd make him make a decision to live by spiritual principles, which is the third step, and then they'd pile him back into bed, hand him a pad, and have him write an inventory. Okay? And they'd sit there and they'd work with this guy through his inventory, and then he'd fifth step it with somebody, usually a priest or whatever, nun or whoever, and then they'd have him do 6 and 7, and they'd let him out of the hospital, and as soon as that guy hit the bricks, he was making amends. Okay? He had his inventory list, which he made his amends list from, and he went out and he started to make amends. And when he got done with that, they taught him how to do all those things in 10, 11, 12. What they were doing was they found out that people like the Washingtonians earlier and the Oxford group had found a very interesting secret, and that is that if you practice spiritual principles, you don't have to drink anymore. And that spiritual principles had been solving alcoholism for a long time. Dr. Jung said the same thing. When Roland Hazard was over there and was treated by Jung and came back to the U.S., had all the money in the world, was from a big industrialist family up in New England, and he came back and he came down drunk. And Jung was the best psychiatrist in the world, and he said, well, now I'm done. I was just the smartest guy in the world about alcoholism, and it didn't work. And he went back to Switzerland, and he sat down in front of Jung, and he said, what's going on? And Jung told him, I've never seen an alcoholic of your type recover. Well, you know what? He described that moment as feeling like the gates of hell had just clanged shut on him. And he said, but hasn't anyone ever recovered? And Jung said, yeah. You know, down through history, every now and then, we see people who recover from chronic alcoholism, and it comes in a vast emotional upheaval with a radical change in values and priorities. It comes in the nature of a spiritual experience. and it radically changes the lives of those that it touches. And what Jung said is, I've been trying to create that spiritual experience in you, and I didn't do it. Okay? You know what happened? Roland Hazard came back to the United States and joined the Oxford Group and did not drink again. And then he found an old friend of his from New England whose name was Ebbie Thatcher. And Ebbie Thatcher was being committed for his life because he was a chronic alcoholic. And Roland stood in front of the judge who he knew and said, please release this young man to me because I have solved the alcohol problem. And the judge was kind enough to release Ebbie Thatcher to Roland. And then Ebbie Thatcher got sober in the Oxford Group, and he went to see an old buddy of his that he knew was a chronic alcoholic and was having a big problem, and guess what his name was? Bill Wilson. Okay? The whole deal was based on the idea that spiritual principles could solve alcoholism. And now, where have we gone with that? Keep coming back? Well, bring the body and the mind will follow? What the hell is all that stuff? You know what the truth is here? The truth is that the directions are the same as they were in 1938. Okay? So, my experience with this is that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous between 1968 and 1973 and could not get sober. I got so sick and so burned out and so blown away that I knew I was going to die if I took another drink. And I didn't take another drink for almost a year. Okay? And I moved to Denver. And I was sitting in a Sunday night young people's meeting, which tells you how long ago that was. And this guy named Don is standing up in front and talking about a program of action. And he's talking about there's real directions in this book. And he's standing up there saying, hey, if you don't have 12 steps in your program, don't call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going, whew, well, he's not trying to make any friends. And he said, there are directions in this book. This is a textbook. This is a textbook. And the directions are in here if you go in and look for them. And see, I couldn't find them. You know, I went to the University of Wisconsin. I mean, I have, they've been checking my IQ since I was 12. University used to come by and test me all the time because they thought something really wonderful was going on there, and all it was alcoholism. I went up to him after the meeting and I said, Don, I've been sober for almost a year, and I know I'm going to drink again, and I'm terrified. I know what's going to happen. If this ever happens to me again, I won't survive it. And I don't even know why I'm sober. I don't know. I just, you know, something's going to happen here, and I'm going off the track. And he said, well, tell me what you've done before. And I told him, and he said, well, I have a suggestion for you. And I said, okay. And he said, why don't you just follow the directions? Okay? So we sat down and started at the forward to the first edition where it says to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And I read the book. And he read it to me and I read it to him. Every time it said to do something, I did it. And about the same time, the 1975 International came along to Denver and we had 17,000 drunks there from all over the world. And this guy from Winnipeg named Mac Cheater, who is now dead, stood up and talked about the Golden Slipper Group in Winnipeg and about how they couldn't stay sober. They just, everybody was dying on them. And they were trying to find a way to stay sober. And so they decided that they'd quit talking about the steps. And they'd quit rationalizing about the steps. and they'd quit intellectualizing about the steps, and that they would take a whole new radical approach towards Alcoholics Anonymous. They'd do the steps. And the most amazing thing happened to that group. They stayed sober. And we were amazed at the talk that he gave. And all of us guys that were sitting around there, we were on the hospitality committee for that thing. There were a lot of new people that were in that group. And we decided that afterwards we were going to do that. And so we sat down with the big book and started over what I had started with my sponsor, which is every time it said to do something, to do it. When it said pray, we prayed. When it said make a decision, we made a decision. When it said write, we wrote. When it said do anything, we did it. If it would have said get up and go to the bathroom, we would have done it. Okay? And what happened from that, and I can't tell you this 100% because I don't know where all those people went. That was in 1975. And out of the 15 or so people that were in that group, I don't know anybody that ever drank. Which isn't to say that they didn't, but of all the people that I still know, none of them ever drank. And I'm the youngest one in the group. Okay? At the beginning of the fifth chapter, which oddly is called How It Works, it talks about how it doesn't work. It talks about people that fail. See, and I know people that come through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and try and hang their hat on anything to fail. And it talks about those people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates, right? And there are some people who really want to fail here. The truth about that is that in the whole time that I've been sober, I can count the number of people that fit that description on one hand. So if you're trying to hang your hat on being constitutionally incapable, you're blowing smoke up your butt. Okay? It's funny to watch people come in Alcoholics Anonymous because likes attract here. Did you ever notice that? All the step workers hang out with the step workers and all the bullshitters hang out with the bullshitters. Did you ever notice that? Maybe you ought to look at who you're sitting next to. The book says, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could neither postpone nor evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is or he isn't. He's either everything or he's nothing. It says, what's your choice to be? My self-imposed crisis is not my alcoholism. My self-imposed crisis is that I can't fix myself. I suffer from a fatal and degenerative disease, and I can't stop it. That's my crisis, and it's self-imposed. Nobody threw me down and poured liquor down my throat. An alcoholic because of a twist of fate. I am an alcoholic because I probably had some predisposition to it and then piled a ton of alcohol on top of it. Okay? I didn't just magically show up in a bar stupid. I can't postpone my problem. I can't say, give me a month off because I'm really sick, this stuff's killing me. I can't run away from my alcoholism because I am it and it goes with me. Okay? Can't go someplace else and solve the problem. I am my alcoholism. And see, I can't fix myself. And the book says, no human power can relieve my alcoholism. That means you can't fix me either. Okay? Now I'm in a quandary. I can't fix me, and you can't fix me, so who is going to fix me? The next line in the book is here we are squarely confronted with the issue of faith. Oh boy, there better be a God here, because otherwise, I'm out of luck. There is no one. There's no one left. If you can't do it and I can't do it, there better be a God, or I'm SOL. Okay? My sponsor was reading me this part in the about the third step, and it talks about selfishness, self-centeredness being the root of our problems. And he told me, he said, Bob, you know, your alcoholism is all this stuff about self, selfishness and dishonesty and resentment and fear. That's what your alcoholism is. And I said, this is kind of a Zen thing, right? And he said, no. And I said, come on, Don. My alcoholism is that I see a bottle of booze and I want to crawl into it. Okay, that's my alcoholism. And once I start drinking, I can't put it down forever. That's my alcoholism. And he said, no, 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 you're wrong. If you can get in touch with selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, you won't ever drink again. And not only won't you ever drink again, you won't even want to drink again. And he was right. Talked about the actor who wants to run the whole show. See, everybody thinks that's the director. They think it's, they're talking about a director. They're talking about some bit player that's telling all the other actors what to do, and it irritates them, makes them mad, and then they retaliate seemingly without cause. Why did you do that to me? Because you're a jerk. It talks about people like us trying to pound round pegs in square holes. Okay? And if we don't get our way, we just try harder, push harder. And then he asked me if I was willing to take a third step with him. And I said, well, if you tell me what that is, I'll give you an answer. And he said, I'm going to read you the prayer. The prayer is, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. And he said, what does that mean to you? And I said, well, it means, I guess, that God can give God, God gets a choice about anything he wants. He can do anything with me. And he said, that's right. Anything. Kill you, leave you alive, make you sick, well, here, there, doesn't make any difference. God's deal. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. You know, my bondage truly is self. My life is like looking in a periscope that's aimed at my forehead. And all I can see is me. And so I spend my whole life pole vaulting over mouse turds because I think everything's such a big deal. I can't see you. All I see is me. I am chained to myself. That is my bondage. And it says, relieve me. Let me look at you. I get so tired of looking at me. God, that takes a lot of energy. Let me just look out, okay? That I may better do thy will. You want to really have a good day sometimes? Spend the whole day doing stuff for other people, okay? You just say, oh, I'm not having much fun lately. Go out and spend the whole day doing stuff for other people and see if you don't feel better, okay? It's true. The book talks about getting on the basis of putting others' welfare above our own. And if we do that, we become happier for some reason. Why is that? Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Bearing witness means being an example. And all it's saying is, God, let me be an example. Let people see that 24 years ago, I was dead meat. I had no place to go, nothing to do, and nobody to do it with, and I was out of gas, and I was going to die. And your power and your love and your way of life interceded in my life. And my life changed. And that is the sole reason for the change. I didn't do anything at all. So he said, you go home and consider that prayer and you come back in a week. And if you want to do it, you get down on your knees and do it with me. And I said, all right. I came back a week later and he said, you want to do that? And I said, no. And he said, why not? And I said, because I don't want to give God that kind of power in my life. And he said, that mean you're not going to do it? And I said, no, I'm just telling you that I don't want to do it. And he said, then get on your knees and hold my hands and say the prayer and mean it. And so I did. Okay? And then he got up and laughed at me. Which I didn't think was too cool. And I said, what's so funny? And he said, you don't want to give God that kind of power in your life. And I said, no, I don't. And he said, he's got all the power anyway. He said, this is just an exercise in who's God and who's the drunk. I think they go to a special school. He said, you bring a legal pad? And I said, yes. And he said, then let's sit down and start writing the inventory. And I said, just like that? Just jump right from this to that? And he goes, yeah. It says this will have little permanent effect unless it's a once followed by a rigorous attempt to clean house. And I'm going, you know, this is really serious business. There ought to be a place in that book that says, now take a month off. You know, I something that just really gets under my skin. Well, there's a lot of things that get under my skin, but fortunately I write a lot of inventory. That people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and other people come up and stroke them and say, that's all right. Let's wait until your mind clears up. And then, after you feel much better, as if they ever will, we'll get into this silly step stuff. Okay? And don't worry about the God thing. We'll talk about that some other time. Okay? What's the most compelling statement in the Big Book? What's the most compelling single statement in that whole book? With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. When's that? That's the day they come through the door. You think people are too stupid or too burned out to do steps? Don't believe it. Because you get to do this more than once. Okay? Why do you think they put the line in the book, more will be revealed to you? Because if you and I ever saw all our character defects at once, it would either kill us or drive us nuts. Okay? If you're anything like I am. So I wrote out this whole thing. He said, write down a grudge list. I want you to write down all these people, institutions, and principles that you don't like. And I said, okay. And I wrote that down and wrote down why I didn't like them, which I was having a lot of fun with. And he said, you know, in that second column, Bob, don't put a lot down there because it doesn't mean a lot. And I was really getting up ahead of steam about talking about how those people had misused me. And he told me not to write more than 4 or 5 words in that column. It just took all the fun out of it. And then he asked me to write down what it affected, my self-esteem or my security or my ambitions or my personal or sex relations or my pocketbook. And I started looking at all the stuff I believed. Okay? I believed that AA was a reward system, and that if I did this stuff, that God was going to put a little halo over my head and make my life just one big bunch of peaches and cream. Okay? That's a lie. I believe that other people ought to be nice to me. Good. I believed all kinds of stuff didn't work. I mean, I grew up believing all kinds of stuff didn't work. Most of what I believed didn't work. Most of what I believed was in conflict with something else I believed. And I could never, ever find that out without looking for it. And I wrote all these people and institutions and principles and what it affected, and I came back to him and I said, okay, Don, I'm done. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, what's left? And he said, you go back in each one of those resentments and write down where you were selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. And now you're going to start to learn something. Okay? And I found out what I was up to. I found out how I mistreat people. I found out how self-centered and selfish and arrogant I am. And I went back and I said, I'm done. And he said, no, you're not. Now you got to write a fear inventory. And I said, I'm not afraid of anything. And he said, well, that's not in keeping with what the book says. And I said, I don't care. I'm not afraid of anything. You know me. I was a bill collector on the north side of Chicago. I used to kick in people's doors. I was a 240-pound psychopath. And I used to beat them up against the wall until they fell down in the fetal position. And I told them I didn't give a good goddamn if they had to go rob a 7-Eleven. They better come up with the money or things were going to start breaking around there. Okay? I was a very nice person. I said, I'm not afraid of anything. You know what I was. And he said, well, humor me. And I said, all right. And he said, how about snakes? And I said, what kind of snakes? And he said, what about rattlesnakes? And I said, well, you'd have to be stupid to want to be in a closet with one. And he said, write down rattlesnakes. And I said, all right. And he said, how about spiders? And I said, you mean like black widows? And he said, uh-huh. And I said, well, you'd have to be pretty ignorant to want to get bit by one. And he said, uh-huh. Write down spiders. So I did. And he said, how about failure? Oh, cheap shot. Yeah. And I said, well, you know, they were telling me when I was a kid that I was going to wind up dying in a gutter just like my dad. And he said, write down failure. How about inadequacy? Well, you know, I never thought I was as good as anybody else. And so I was resented the hell out of everybody else because I thought they were better than I was. And I had no reason to feel that I was as good as other people. And he said, write down inadequacy. How about women? Oh, come on. He said, just write down women. How about children? Well, you know, the real little tiny ones that they go, you hold them, and I go, no, I'll drop them. And he said, write down infants. How about the police? Oh, well, you mean like when they're right behind you in the squad car? And he goes, yeah, that's good. And I went, uh-huh. And he said, how about the courts? Well, I got sentenced to 2 years in the Green Bay State Reformatory for assault with a deadly weapon when I was 17 years old. And I figured I got misused. They should have sent me there for 5 years. He said, write down the courts. And then there was a very long pregnant silence. And he looked at me and he said, is there anything you're not afraid of? And I said, I guess not. Well, what's the book say? The book says that fear is an evil and corroding thread and the fabric of our existence is shot through with it. The fabric of my existence was shot through with fear. When I was the most terrible bill collector that you can imagine, there were days when I could not get out of the fetal position. I would be so locked up in fear that the doctor would have to come to my house and give me some sort of relaxant to get out of that position because I knew that every day when I went out, I might get shot, killed in some other manner. And the book talks about faith being the solution in that we begin to outgrow fear. Doesn't say we outgrow it. Doesn't say you're going to be sober 20 years and you're never going to be afraid again. It just says we learn to outgrow it. Okay? So I wrote this whole list and I came back and I said, I'm done. And he said, no, now you got a sex inventory. oh boy, now we're going to have some fun. And I found out that it really wasn't about that, that it was about, were my relationships selfish or not? I don't want to know that. Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Oh, man. Okay. You know, I went into a sex inventory thinking I was Don Juan. And I came out looking like Elmer Fudd. Every relationship I ever had was selfish. You know, I'm in the process of writing inventory now. I go through the steps about once a year. The group that I belong to is pretty fundamentalist, and there are those of us in AA too, and there are a wide variety of ways that people practice this program, and we just happen to be the fundamentalist branch. And I write inventory once a year, usually. I mean, don't do it on some anniversary. I just have the feeling to write it because I want to keep clear. And a clear mind is the greatest gift besides the ability to choose that I think that I've gotten out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just delight in having a clear mind. When I was about 7 years sober, I got divorced from a marriage that hadn't worked for about 10 years, and then I was single for another 5 years. And in that 5 years, I was a big, you know, mover and shaker. I went out with three different women in those 5 years, and two of them only once. I always thought of myself as quite a swinger, and this one, I really felt that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her. And I absolutely knew at 10 years sober that I didn't have a clue. That I didn't know any more about having a relationship than jumping over the moon. I knew that I was just terribly unequipped to be worthwhile in a relationship. And I kept asking in my 11th step to be clear. And it led me to a woman that I went to see about it. And her name kept coming up in my 11th step. And she had me go through these silly exercises with my girlfriend. And she would bring my girlfriend over when I had this meeting with her. And she'd say, Bob, is there something about Lori over here that really makes you mad? And I went, uh-huh. And she'd go, well, what was it? And I went, well, she said so-and-so really hurt me. And I'd go, and she'd look at Lori, and she'd say, is that what you said? And Lori'd go, no. And she'd say, well, what did you say? And Lori'd go, well, I said this. And, well, that isn't what I heard. And this woman turned around and looked at me, and she said, you have really faulty hearing, Bob. See, I have a really bad habit. And I found it in inventory. And the bad habit is I hear what I think you're going to say. Okay? And so she said, maybe you just don't hear people right. So I went, okay. She said, is there anything else that Lori said that hurt you? And I said, yeah. She said this and this. And I said, and she turned around. She said, Lori, is that what you said? And Lori said, no, that isn't what I said at all. This is what I said. And I'm going, well, that isn't what I heard. And this woman's looking at me and said, we've already established that. And what I found out is that I don't hear. I am so selfish and self-centered that I decide what you're going to say. Okay? Oh, my. That's really sick. And so I went around for almost a year when someone would hurt me, and I would say, excuse me, I just heard you say this. That's what I heard. Is that what you said? That hurt me. And see, 99% of the time they'd go, no. That isn't what I said at all. Okay? Isn't that awful? Putting yourself, makes you feel like you're stupid. I want to know. I mean, I really want to get as close to God as I can. I really do. And I can't do that without putting myself at risk all the time. And taking positions where I say, I don't understand. I don't know what you're telling me. Will you please just take the time to explain it to me? Okay? On the end of my inventory, I took the take it to the grave stuff. That's usually something about sex. You know what? I've listened to God knows how many fifth steps, and I never heard anything new after the fourth one. And so, unless you've learned how to do it with lasers or something, half the people in this room have already done it. So don't hang around with that, you know, until the end of your fifth step, because it's going to make you feel bad. Just put it right out there in the beginning, and then you can get relaxed for the rest of your fifth step. You know, just. I went and fifth stepped with my sponsor, and you need to know that I am I mean, that looks like bashful sometimes, but I'm a loner. Okay. I don't get close to people easily. It's a character defect of mine. You know, I'll tell you that freely. I lived with four different families by the time I was 10. I was abandoned by my mother twice. I don't get close to people easily. I am uncomfortable around other people. And I'm trying to figure out why I do that, and I don't want to do that anymore. But the truth about that is that's the way I am, all these years of sobriety and everything. Okay? So when I told my sponsor my whole fifth step, I expected him to get up and say, Bob, I understand that you needed to do this, but I would appreciate it if you wouldn't come around my house anymore. And I don't think I would like to have you close to my wife or my children, and please don't tell anyone I'm your sponsor. And that's what I expected. And what he did was he put his arms around me. And he told me he loved me, and that he was delighted that I had followed the directions. And I took my book home and my inventory, and it says taking the book down from the shelf, so I put it up on the shelf and took it down. I reviewed the first five proposals, you know, the first five steps, see whether I'd made mortar without sand, is what it says. And I looked at it, and I knew I was pretty clear about it. And that I hadn't left anything out. And I told God that I was willing, in the sixth step, that he remove all those things which he had found objectionable. Okay? And then I said the seventh step prayer. I sat around and considered that for an hour, just like it said. Now, there's a thing in the book there that talks about people like you and I drinking again, and it's very important. It says, it talks about harboring resentment and anger, okay? And it says, when harboring such feelings, providing them safe harbor, giving them a home, when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit, from God. And the insanity of alcohol returns. And we drink again. And for us, to drink is to die. See? And so for people like you and I, if we don't want to drink again, we can't be harboring those things. Because resentments will kill more alcoholics than any single thing. Okay? I need to put them out in the open and get rid of them. So, I made a list of all these people I'd harmed. I went to my sponsor. He told me, it says we made a list of all people we'd harmed, and we became willing to make amends to them all. We did it when we took inventory. That's the line in the book that follows it. So it means that if I didn't write my inventory out of the book, I don't have an amends list there. Okay? So I don't know if you have this feeling about using somebody's guide, but if you're using somebody's guide besides the big book, I think it causes more problems than it cures. Okay? You also need to know that I believe if your intent is to live spiritually, you can't do anything wrong. I don't think that if you don't do this exactly right that God's going to kill you. Because if he did, we'd all be dead. Okay? So I made a list of all these people and I reviewed it with my sponsor and I had written down the harm. He told me I had to do that so I was clear before I went to anybody about how I harmed them. And that when I got in front of them, I wasn't wasting their time and I knew exactly what I had done to them and I was willing to balance the books to make that right. Okay? So we went through that. I owed a lot of money. That was 1973, 74. I owed $15,000, I think, somewhere around there. And so I was trying to pay all that stuff off. And he asked me about my dad. And he said, well, are you going to make amends to your dad? And I said, no. And he said, why not? And I said, well, this guy came around and beat me up. You know, I mean, what the hell did I ever do to him? And he said, your dad was a real chronic alcoholic, wasn't he? And I said, yeah, he sure was. And he said, yeah, didn't you tell me that he used to call you on your birthday every year? And I said, yeah, I did. And he said, what was that like? And I said, he would be so drunk that I couldn't ever understand what he was saying. All I knew is that it was him, and there was this, yeah, unintelligible mumble on the other end. And he said, what did you do? And I said, I'd hang up on him. And he'd say, why'd you do that? And I said, because he's an alcoholic. And my sponsor said, you're an alcoholic. He said, give me a minute. Are you telling me, And you know how this feels, that a chronic alcoholic who was half out of his mind all the time had the presence of mind to call you on a specific day every year to wish you the best and tell you to see if you were all right? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you know how much effort that takes for someone in that position? And I said, yeah, I do. And he said, then you better go make amends. And I said, for what? And he said, for holding him at arm's length your whole life because he was an alcoholic. Well, I said, well, shit, he lives in Wisconsin. I mean, what do you expect me to get? He had a stroke already. If I go there, the doctor told me that he has no continuous thought, that his mind's out of here. What's the point? And he said, this is about clean off our side of the street. I don't care what your dad did. All I care about is what you did. You go clean it off. And I don't care. He's going to pay his own prices for whatever he did. Okay? But you go clean off your side of the street. That means you get in your car, you drive to Wisconsin, you go to the Grand Army home, and you get in front of him, and I don't care if he understands or he doesn't. I like that kind of direction. I mean, it's clear. So I did. And see, I went in the Grand Army home, and there's this little old man living in a wheelchair. And I walked up to him, and I hadn't seen him in like 15 years. And I stood in front of him, and he looked up at me, didn't recognize me, and I said, hi, I'm your son, Bob. And he became very happy. And I said, I need to talk with you. And I wheeled him off into a room, and I sat down in front of him, and I looked him right in the eye, and I said, I'm an alcoholic. And then he wasn't so happy, because he knew what that was. And I said, but I don't have to drink anymore, because I'm in this program. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And part of the recovery program is to make amends to those people we have harmed. And I have harmed you. And I regret having done that. And I will do whatever is necessary to make that right.
And when I told him I didn't drink anymore, I got very excited again. And see, I understood. I mean, he understood. He heard what I was saying. And it wasn't long after that that he couldn't. Okay? Let me tell you what. My dad's a drunk. Was a drunk. My dad's dead. My dad got adult onset diabetes as a direct result of the imbalance that was caused by his alcoholism. And they called my uncle Leif and they said, we're going to have to cut his feet off. Because the circulation left his feet. And so they amputated his feet. And then they called my uncle Leif again. They said, we're going to have to take off more of his leg and we may have to take off one of his hands. And what would you like us to do? And my uncle's going, well, tell me where this is going. And the doctor said I was going to. What you need to know is that at some point that disease will progress to the trunk of his body and he will die of gangrene. And there's no way to stop it. So we can either keep taking pieces off of him or we can let him die now. What do you want to do? So my Uncle Leif thought the kindest thing to do was to let him die. And he told the doctor to do that. And I don't question that decision. Except my dad knew what it was. Okay? And so he would sit in this hospital and he knew he had no decision in his own life anymore. And when people would come close to him, he would scream at them from his wheelchair because he couldn't talk. And the four horsemen of alcoholism are terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And despair is the greatest of them all. And that's the way he died. He died like a drunk dies. And you and I don't have to. Ten's about watching. It's about being vigilant. It's about the instructions in the 10th step are continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When you see it, ask God at once to remove it. You talk to someone. You make amends about it. You make amends if you've harmed someone, and you resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. Okay? The book says we turn our thoughts to someone we can help. You listen to Emmett Fox. He says turn your thoughts to God. But what it's talking about is the periscope. What it's saying is if you're into self, you're in danger. So turn your thoughts out. Think about someone you can help. And that's the best trick in the 10th step. Okay? And 11 is about discipline. It talks about in this way God disciplines us. It is my belief that not 5% of all the people in Alcoholics Anonymous follow those directions. Okay? In my experience, it tells us what to do when we get up in the morning. We ask God to keep our day free from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. It asks us to for God to give us intuitive thought or a decision if we run into a problem. It says we pray for people that we think we need to pray for, and then we ask God to, and then we plan our day, which means we have a real plan for today. There's enormous spiritual virtue in having a planned day. And then it says, God, show me all through the day what my next step is to be, and please give me whatever I need to take care of the problems. God bless. And it says, when I go to bed at night, I need to review my day. And I need to see something very interesting. I need to see whether I put more into it than I took out of it. Am I a taker or a giver? I need to stay on that side of the equation. And I need to review it every night. You know, I'm not supposed to go into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection because I make mistakes all the time. Okay? I'm just supposed to look at it. It says that I have to have attitudes as I go through the day. Thy will, not mine, be done, and I'm not running the show anymore. Okay? And the best trick in there is we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. Just step back. Say, God, show me what's going on here. Okay? I work with a lot of people. A lot of people think the 12th step is about working with other people, but the real tough part of that step is practicing these principles in all our affairs, which means I got to take it into my marriage, and I got to take it to work, And I got to take it to all those other areas of my life, or I am a hypocrite and a liar. Well, you know what? I work with a lot of new drunks. Around Denver, they say, you better get your shit together or you're going to wind up with Bob Olson as a sponsor. I don't care. Bring them on. I don't care if they're nuts. I don't care if they're 6'8" and psychopathic. I don't care. You know what? God's protected me through all this weird stuff. You know what? God has given me an enormous amount of grace. He has given me a purpose in my life. He has allowed me to become on the ever-advancing, what the book calls the leading edge of His ever-advancing creation. I get to be part of God's will, hopefully. And I love to do that. If that sounds good to you, do what I did. Trust God, clean house, work with others. Thanks a lot.